I didn't know Barry King before I walked into his house a few months ago to do this interview, my first on-site interview. Dennis Henderson, who I had interviewed months prior, had suggested that I talk with King for an episode, and frankly, I'm really glad I did. In doing my research on him, I came across an article that Dave Richards, Dr. Rock, had written about Barry a few years ago when he was presented with an award for his musical career by the nonprofit educational group, Odessa's Place. You can see an image of that article on Barry's episode page, but I can sum it up by saying this guy has been playing multiple instruments, but especially guitar, since he was 9 years old living in Chicago. Since then, he's lived quite a musical life, and I was honored to have him on the podcast. So settle in for episode 29 featuring Barry King.
All right, Barry King, welcome to your living room.
Yeah, you invited.
Thanks for having me here. My first on-site interview. This is great. So let's start with the fact that you came from Chicago, is that right, in the 70s?
Yep.
And what brought you here?
My family moved here. My mother, she had moved here years before and tried to, I had an aunt who lived here, so she came here to get on her feet, get working, and my aunt got it working and everything, and get herself together because Chicago wasn't a very good fit for her. So she came here, and when she finally got her feet under us, she came to Chicago and got us, me and my brothers and my sister.
What year are we talking? Mid-70s?
Well, right around the end of 1970.
Okay, all right. And were you already a musician at that time?
Yeah, I had actually started playing in a couple of clubs in Chicago, actually when I was 13.
Oh.
So I had a lot of cousins and stuff. That were, if my immediate parents weren't available to chaperone, you know, I had some 21-year-old cousins and stuff that could go and act as chaperone for me. But I started pretty early.
And are we talking just guitar? Because I know you play multiple instruments.
Well, the clubs that I used to play at in Chicago, I played bass. But doing a lot of the like summer festivals and stuff like that, you know, I play guitar. That's my main instrument.
That's your main instrument. That's what I wondered. Yeah. And so, how early did you start? You said you started young.
I started when I was 9.
Okay.
And it's kind of funny, cause it was a weird story. I didn't even know I liked music. I mean, other than listening to it, you know, on the radio and all that type of stuff. As far as playing music, it never crossed my mind. But I wanted a chemistry set for Christmas, and as inquisitive as I was, my parents, I don't think they wanted the house blown up. So among some of the other gifts, my uncle bought me a guitar.
Okay.
And I picked it up and messed around with it a little bit. You know, Christmas Day, you're going to mess around with everything.
Right.
But it sat in the corner for a couple of weeks. Now, my uncle, he was in a wheelchair, but he could do just about anything. You know, he's kind of a real jack of all trades.
Okay.
But he asked me one day to hand him that guitar, and he started tuning it, and I'm like, okay, this is new.
He knew how to play it?
Well, kind of, sort of.
Okay.
He knew some, you know, open chords, C, F, and G, you know, and sang some of the old country songs that his father used to sing with him.
Okay.
And he showed me three chords, and I caught on to him so quick. I was like, you know what? I kind of like this. And I just took it from there. And after that, man, I just couldn't get enough of it. Everything I listened to, I was had my guitar in my hand trying to emulate it. You know, sitcoms.
Oh, yeah.
Cartoon music, songs on the radio.
Was it an acoustic or was it electric?
Yeah, actually, it was a Howdy Doody guitar.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I eventually graduated to a better acoustic guitar. One of my other uncles, he was a state trooper, and he bought a guitar at a police auction.
Huh.
And he gave it to me. And it was a good guitar, but, you know, it wasn't real expensive.
Right.
But it was better than what I had.
Yeah.
And the promise was that if I took care of it and everything continued to progress, they would think about trying to get me something better. You know, so.
Okay. And it just kind of went from there.
Yeah, pretty much. And then after that, you know, when I found out there was something that came kind of easy, and I was pretty good at it, I just started gravitating to other instruments and stuff. You know, anything I put my hands on, if I could get a tune out of it, you know, if you leave it with me for a little bit, come back and get it, I'll play you something on
it. Wow.
So.
Huh. But guitar always your favorite.
Yeah.
And so you're in Chicago. Like you said, you start playing in some clubs when you're young.
Yeah, I was 13.
Okay. And, I mean, how was that? I mean, were you playing with, like, kids your age or?
No, actually, I played with this this guy. He was an old Chess recording artist.
Oh.
His name was Willie Mabon.
Okay.
He's a friend of the families in a direct way. So that's how I was introduced to him through, you know, my parents knew him. And he was playing at a local club in Chicago, so they brought him around, and he liked the way I played.
Wow.
He said, you know, the club owners, they was like, look, you know, if he can't be in here by himself, and I had chaperones, so
right.
Okay, it was started from there.
So it wasn't a one-time thing? You played with him?
Oh, no, I played with him pretty much every weekend.
Wow, a 13-year-old kid. So people must have been coming out to see you.
Yeah, it was a lot to saw me. I mean, he was the headliner.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
But you know, it was hey y'all, this young guy playing that bass, you know.
Yeah,
you get that kind of talk. So.
Oh, so you're playing bass with him at the time?
I played bass for him.
Oh, okay.
He had a guitarist. He played piano and sang, and a drummer. His bass player was a local guy, and I don't even remember why he was no longer their bass player, but he
yeah.
Up until I started with him, he used to have different guys come in, you know, that weekend to cover.
Yeah.
And
were these originals? Was he playing his own stuff or?
Yeah, he played his own stuff. Now he only had a couple of radio hits at the time, so naturally he played those. But just like every other blues guy, they all sing each other's stuff.
Gotcha. Right. Yeah. And so you obviously caught the bug because you started performing that young and you've been playing all these years, right? I mean,
yeah, pretty much. Matter of fact, when I first moved here, my uncle and a friend of his got me a job playing for Sam Jethro up at the Steakhouse when it used to be on 15th and Parade Street.
Wow.
And the thing was, they had already let him know that, look, this kid's already been playing in the clubs.
And
so,
you're how old at this point?
Well, I was getting ready to turn 17 then.
Okay, so you come to Erie around 17.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. All right, and so you're playing for Sam Jethro.
Yeah.
I mean, how was that?
It was good because I started meeting some of the local musicians, and on Saturday afternoons he'd have a matinee. You know, it's what you call a jam session these
days. Oh, okay. All right.
And I got a chance to meet a lot of local musicians and stuff, and I think my mother kind of knew that was going to happen because she knew I really didn't want to come here. And by me meeting some of the local musicians and playing in these little bands and stuff, it would be some of the incentive for me to stay here.
Right. Gotcha. So, you know, I looked up some stuff on you, and you and I had chatted beforehand. So talk to me about is it the Patterson Twins Review?
Yeah, the Patterson Twins were two local guys. They were recording under a label in Jackson, Mississippi called Malico.
Okay.
And I ended up getting to know them, and they were getting ready to go on the road. They had this one group called the Sunfrost Review.
And they're from Erie?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
But thing was, they had just recorded a new record.
Okay.
They were getting ready to go on a southern trip. The group that they had with them, they weren't, how can I say it? They weren't really geared to playing the kind of music that was going to be expected from these guys on this southern tour.
And this is like funk and soul, right?
Well, yeah, R&B and blues.
Okay. All right, R&B and blues. Gotcha.
And me and a couple of other local guys, we had a little band at the time, and they had approached us about would we be willing to travel with them, and I said why not, you know. So we went on the road with those guys for a while, about 3 or 4 months.
And where are we talking?
Jackson, Mississippi, Little Rock, Arkansas.
Wow.
I played on a show with them guys in Greenville, Mississippi, on a show with an old legendary blues guy by the name of Little Milton.
Okay.
And that was kind of fun, too, because Greenville happened to be a town in Mississippi where one of my aunts lived. So
you got to go see her, or she came to come see you.
Yeah, well, the club that we played at wasn't very far from where she lived. So.
Okay.
You know, that kind of worked out both ways for me because I didn't have to pay for a hotel.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you were young. I mean, how was it, life on the road, like you were digging was it?
Right around that time, when I went on the road with the twins, I was already past 21. I can't remember exactly how old
I
was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you're an adult at this time, but I'm thinking still, like, you're a young guy. Like, you're probably thinking, this music thing is awesome. I'm on the road touring with these guys. Were you making any money?
We made a little money.
Yeah.
Could have been better. But,
sure.
At the time, you own that, what they call that Chitlin circuit. You know?
Yeah.
And the Patterson Twins, they weren't the real huge megastars.
Right.
So we made nominal money, but we made money. You know, and for myself and musicians that weren't working and stuff back then, it was decent. Nothing I could retire on.
Right, but, right.
Hey, you know.
Were you playing bass or guitar for them?
Oh, I was playing guitar.
Okay, all right.
Guitar and singing vocals.
Did you record it all with them? Because I know they recorded a few albums, right?
I did some touch up work on the record that they were doing at the time.
Okay.
It was called Back in Love Again.
Yeah, yeah.
And not LTD's Back in Love
Again,
by the way.
Yeah, gotcha. Different one. Yeah. All right. All right. So what happens? You said you're on the road for 3 months or so with them. I mean, does the tour just end?
Yeah, well, you know, they pretty much, when we got back, you know, they didn't have any more dates.
Sure.
So I went back to playing at the local clubs. And it was, back then, it was sustainable.
It was.
You know, because there were plenty of clubs to play at. You know, the Pope Hotel, the ULC Club, the Arbiters,
yeah,
Steakhouse, and that was just in our community. Plus the local events in the summer. You know, back then it was called We Love Erie Days.
Oh yeah, right, right.
They didn't have a jazz and blues festival and stuff back then, but they used to have like East Side, West Side reunion parties and stuff like that. There was a big host. They'd host it for a couple of days out in a, you know, in a big open park.
Yeah.
Area. And they'd always have different bands come in and out. So, and it was always some of the top locals. They really, you know, the little garage bands, it wasn't really a venue for
sure.
A lot of those guys back in the days.
So you were playing in some popular bands back then.
Yeah, pretty much. Sky's the Limit. I played with them. I had a 10-piece group called Ready, Willing, and Able.
Right. I knew that.
Then,
well, first of all, talk to me about Sky's the Limit, because I've heard so much about them over the years. Like, were you with them a long time or?
Not really a long time. I played with them for about a year, maybe a year and a half at the most. They were all younger guys.
Right. I know Kenny Hollis was in the band for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Kenny Hollis, Rusty Jackson.
Right.
Rusty's brother David, who passed away by now.
Okay.
Derek Carson.
A girl singer?
Ann. I forget Ann's last name.
Okay. All right.
But.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that was a band that was around for a long time. And so you played with them for about a year. Was Ready, Willing?
Ann Porter. That
Ann
was
Porter.
The name.
Right. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Ready, Willing, and Able.
That was a band that. Actually, we both got started. We put the bands together out at the JFK Center. Bobby Harrison, he used to sponsor Sky's the Limit, and he decided to, since he had this, you know, access to the center and
right.
equipment and stuff. Kind of opened it up for other groups to come out and have a place to rehearse at
right.
and everything. And we had put together another band, and he kind of thought it was a good, you know, not a bad idea to have two different, you know, groups coming out of the same area.
Yeah.
Although he wasn't our manager or anything like that. He just let us have use of the facilities and helped us, you know, steering toward different people. Like, he was a member of the Kiwanis Club, so naturally we'd have access to a lot of their parties and things of that nature.
Yeah. And did Dennis Henderson, did he tell me he practiced there for a while too, right?
Yeah, they practiced when
the JFK moved?
No, they didn't move. They put up another building.
Oh, yeah. He said it was like a separate little club or something, right?
Right. So yeah. It was like pretty much a big band house.
Yeah. So you guys got to, I mean, that's cool having a standard place to practice and everything. But, I mean, is this where Ready, Willing, and Able practiced? You're talking 10 guys, right?
Yep. It was a good size building.
It was? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Eventually, when we broke off from the JFK, we had a space upstairs at the OIC building.
Okay.
Used to be over on 15th and German.
All right.
So we moved from out there over to there.
Well, tell me, what are the pieces in a 10-piece band? I mean, you got to have a horn section, right?
Yeah. We had Frank Williams. He used to teach he was a trombone player. He used to teach at Wilson.
Okay.
And we had a guy named Henry Jones. He taught at, I think, Emerson.
Hmm.
And Paris Baker, he's a reverend now.
Okay.
Those are our horn players, trombone, sax, and trumpet.
Got it.
We had Charlie Williams on keyboards, me on guitar, a guy by the name of Robert Poole on bass.
I'm testing your memory.
I'm trying.
We got
Mark Davison was the bass player first.
And okay.
Then we switched him for a guy by the name of Jimmy Johnson.
Okay.
And then we had a three-piece vocal section, girls and a guy, Adrian Robinson, Tina Sales, and Paul Nixon.
Okay, yeah, I know of Tina Sales for sure, yeah.
She was something else.
Yeah, and so where did you guys play?
We played for pretty much the hotels at the time. You know, at the time, the Holiday Inns here was doing bands.
Right.
Ramada Inns was doing bands, you know, other than, you know, parties and stuff, local clubs.
Yeah.
Different things. We had to play at pretty much the bigger clubs and the hotel circuits and stuff like that because we were 10 pieces.
Right.
Some of the local clubs couldn't afford, you know.
Sure, yeah. And, like, what type of stuff were you playing? The music of the day or?
Yeah, we were playing all of the hits, everything pretty much coming out new. Rick James, LTD, George Ben, we was pretty much on top of the charts.
Yeah. And so are these 10 to 2 gigs or, you know, 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock or?
Pretty much back in those days, pretty much they were all 10 to 2.
Okay. And was it, I hear this from a lot of older musicians.
Or 9:30 to 1:30.
Yeah. But was it, you were there for a few days or were these one-off gigs?
The hotels were usually 4 day gigs, at least 4 day gigs. Some were 5.
Oh wow. Okay. Well, that made it easy to set up and, you know, tear down, I guess.
Yeah, and put a good little piece of change in your pockets back then too.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that would keep you busy. So, you're in Sky's the Limit first and then Ready, Willing, and Able, is that right? We got the chronology right. When do you get in with Dennis at the Legend Band?
Well, Dennis, that was, I don't even remember what year that was, but.
Later, 80s, maybe.
Yeah, it was.
Because we haven't talked about Top Shelf yet, and you were in that for 10 years, right?
Yeah, I was in Top Shelf for pretty much all of the 80s.
Okay, all right. Well, so, I mean, am I missing someone, first of all, before we get to Top Shelf? Were there other bands?
I think Dennis was pretty much around the late 70s, early 80s, and then me and him had played off and on, you know, for a long time, so it's kind of hard to pinpoint down exact times, you know.
Yeah, because I know that, you know, one of the things that I know about you is you've played with a lot of different people.
Oh, yeah.
Over the years, right?
Yes, I have.
And how about as far as in the majority of all these bands, are you playing guitar?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, basses, no more.
Well, not as far as playing regularly in a band, but I still did a lot of sideband work.
Oh, you did? Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, and I'm pretty versatile, so.
Sure. Playing a little keyboards?
A little keyboards here and there.
right?
But one thing about when I played bass is I've always had fun with a bass. Bass always came so easy for me, you know, and I can fill in for pretty much anybody at any time,
right?
You know, playing bass.
Gotcha.
Now, playing guitar, that's a little more complicated. You know, I can cover a lot, but I wouldn't really try to cover too many jazz jobs playing guitar.
Yeah.
I wouldn't try to cover any metal jobs or anything like that. Now, classic rock, R&B, blues, I cover any of those on guitar.
What's your favorite?
Oh, blues is my favorite. That's what I grew up listening to in my household.
Yeah.
So obviously that's the first music I played.
Yep. And you said you sang a little bit too.
Yeah, a little bit. That came later on. I really didn't know I had a voice people wanted to hear.
Some lead or backups or both?
Both.
Yeah, both. Okay. Gotcha. All right. So, ready, willing, and able, big band, horn section, doing the lounge act, you know, you're playing around. And then Top Shelf comes along and you stick with them for, like I said, a decade or so, right?
Yeah, we had a long run.
Same type of music or?
We played a variety of music. We did a lot of club music. You know, we did on top of the charts, like we would do some of the new stuff, Tears for Fears. But then we would do some of the R&B music too, like we would do 1999. We did Tone Loc's Wild Thing, Doing the Butt, and all that.
Gotcha.
Stuff. You know, all right. That type of stuff that was back in the day that was
fun dance songs. Yeah.
However, when we did weddings and things like that, we could play like you know how when you go to a wedding, you know, it's gonna be a lot of older people there first,
right?
So we would do stuff like "Only You Can Make This Change in Me,"
gotcha,
and stuff like that. We, you know, so I covered a lot of different styles.
You can pull that stuff out,
and you know that's one of the things that has been one of the things that I've always tried to do is I've always figured the more styles I can play, the more people I can please,
yeah,
the more work I can get,
right?
So
so you've been pretty versatile.
Pretty versatile.
Who were the guys in Top Shelf?
The original version was me, Dan Walker, Tim Driscoll
playing drums,
guy on the keyboard named Eric Christensen.
Oh yeah.
And Dave Cathy.
Okay, who was singing?
Well, Dave did most of the singing at first.
Right.
Dan did about probably the next amount. But then when I got with the group, I started singing. I probably sang more than Dan.
Okay.
And then when we had to let go of Dave, I started doing 3/4 of the vocals because I took over his songs and stuff too then.
So. You had to let go of Dave?
Yeah, I really hated it because Dave was my friend, and Dave was a fantastic musician.
Yeah.
But he had some demons.
Sure, yeah, it happens.
And they got in the way. They got in the way. It happened to get in the way, and they got in the way once too many times. And,
yeah, yeah. You know,
it wasn't my decision. Well, I guess it was a group decision, but Dan was the leader of the band at the time, so.
Okay. And so you mentioned playing weddings. That's the first time I heard you say that.
Oh, yeah. We played a lot of weddings.
That's a whole different gig, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's a different mindset.
Yeah.
You got to know when to pull it back and when to turn it loose.
Right.
And we kind of got them down to a science.
Yeah.
You know? But my thing about weddings, now there's a lot of Italian descent people in Erie.
Sure.
And there's a lot of Polish descent people in Erie.
You got it.
One thing that I used to do that kind of, I would say, put me a step ahead. Well, whenever we play an Italian wedding, we knew how to play the tarantella.
Oh.
And when we did the Polish weddings, we knew how to do the chicken dance.
No, really?
So, and hey, you know, that's going to please somebody.
Absolutely it is.
And things like that, we would do little things like that, little extras to set us apart because We have played some lucrative weddings.
I was going to say, weddings are a whole different thing as far as money, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And if you, and a lot of bands, I never understood it because through my career, I've heard a lot of musicians, man, no, we don't do weddings. I'm like, I don't know why. Those are some of the most lucrative, easiest money that you can make.
Right, right.
And
any demanding or overly demanding wedding or brides or anybody, you got to play this, you got to play that.
You're going to run into those here. Yeah. Man. But, I've always felt like I'm going to please you.
Yeah.
Might not can do exactly that song, but I can do you something in that style.
Yeah, right.
You will like.
Right, yeah.
Or there have been times where if they've had a specialty song, I'd always tell them, send it to me. A week ahead of time or so.
Right.
We'll play it for you.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So, you do little specialty things like that. People are going to remember you.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And back then, to learn those songs, you had to get a record and tape or whatever it was. It's not like today.
Yeah, but, hey, you do what you got to do to make the money.
Sure, sure. Did you guys, and you had some pictures for me, which I'll post on your episode page. I don't remember looking at it so briefly. Did you guys have outfits that you wore? Did you all dress alike or similar? Or
with three groups I played with, we did. With the Patterson Twins, we had outfits.
Okay.
With Ready, Willing, and Able, we had outfits. And with Top Shelf, we had outfits.
Okay, yeah. I wondered about that. Is that that's a band decision, right? We're all going to dress this same way each time, right?
And right. Sometimes it's the same style. Sometimes it's the same colors. Sometimes just don't have to necessarily be the same style as long as it's the same colors.
Yeah, right,
just
right.
Everybody coordinated.
And that was just the way it was done. It was being more professional.
Yeah, well, that's when you play in hotels and things like that also. That's kind of what they expected.
Okay.
They want you to look the part.
Right, right.
And I'm going to tell you, I've always felt that looks, how you look can almost be just as important as how you sound.
That's a great point.
Yeah. For instance, you're getting ready to hire a band for an event, not just a bar, for an event. You get two bands. They both play the same music, same stuff. They both play it well.
Mm-hmm.
You could go wrong with either one. But the one group come in with jeans and tie-dye shirts and sneakers on, and the other group come in with matching outfits.
Yeah.
Which one are you going
to
choose?
Right, right. Did you have to do, I don't know how it goes. Did you have to try out sometimes for weddings or how did you get gigs? Because I know in the past, people would put together tapes and
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, well, that's what we did.
Okay.
And to ensure that we got a chance at nailing some of the better jobs.
Yeah.
We went through a couple of agents.
Oh, you did?
At the time.
So. Oh, okay.
And turned out that paid off that paid off well for us because this one agency we called Progressive Talent at the time.
Sure.
They really kept us working. They kept us, matter of fact, they kept Top Shelf working so much that my bass player and my drummer would tell him certain days not to book anything because their wives, they were going to go on vacation on.
Right, right. So that was Dennis Cohen?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And man, I'm telling you, that band probably worked more than any band that I have been in since I've been in the area. We played anywhere from 50 to 52 weeks a year.
Whoa. And this is Top Shelf.
Yep.
Yeah.
We play at least 48 to 50, I'll say, out of 52 weeks a year.
Well, we've covered a lot of decades, or at least a few decades for you. What did you have a regular job, or were you just a musician?
No, I've had regular jobs. Some of them were spread out there a little bit, but I'll say for this last part of my life, probably other than through some of the temp agencies, things like that, I worked for Abraxas, the Abraxas Foundation.
Yeah.
I worked there for a few years. I worked running a homeless shelter up here called The Refuge.
Oh.
I did that for about almost 5 years. Then I left there, and I worked at St. Vincent's for almost 10.
In the 70s, did you ever work for GCAC?
Yeah, I did. Man, I almost forgot about JK.
I have a picture of you.
I was one of the first guys when they first started the weatherization program.
Right. Yeah. I saw a picture of you in the paper from 1978 doing the weatherization. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Cool.
I'd like to see that.
I'll find that for you. Yeah, for sure. So you ran through, off the top of your head, some of the old bars and you know, stuff that you played in early in your early days. But during, for Top Shelf, like, I found a whole bunch of different, you know, places that you were playing, like the Hedge Hollow Inn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an experience.
Yeah, well, tell me about that.
Our saxophone player got his saxophone stolen there.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I've heard of the place.
That was a strange one. We almost thought we were going to do something illegal to get paid that night.
Oh, really?
Guy tried to slip out with the money.
Oh, okay. And this place was out on Route 20, right?
Yep.
Okay, all right.
I'll never forget that one.
All right. You know, I often ask folks, like, what are some of your most memorable gigs, whether it be good or bad? What do you tell, you know, your grandson, you know, hey, I remember this one time. How about worst?
Worst, as far as now, there's different kinds of worst.
Yeah, like Dennis told me the story where they had to play at Mercy Earth, and their lead singer showed up totally drunk and unexpected. They didn't even expect him, and people hated them, you know. And he said that was terrible, you know. But
oh yeah, not that you mention it. Ready, willing, and able.
Okay.
Now, back then there was a band from Cleveland called 7 Miles High.
Okay.
They were very good.
All right.
And like a lot of the groups around town, like some of the fraternities that would have the big parties, they would hire this band out of Cleveland, 7 Miles High.
Okay.
So the Q's always used to have this party, and they would always hire 7 Miles High. Until this one year, they heard us, and they decided to hire us.
Okay.
So that was a feather in the cap. So at sound check that day, we come in, everybody's psyched for this job. We come in, take a sound check. Music is, system is sounding good. The music is sounding good. We all in good spirits. So we parked and everybody meet back here at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
We have to go on at 8. We get back. Now, a lot of us back in them days, we get there early.
Sure.
And everybody's there but our bass player. So 6:30, 6:45. Our singer, Adrian, she comes in. She said, y'all got to see Jimmy. Jimmy comes staggering down the steps with his bass. All right. Oh, man, Jimmy, he's toe up. Well, let's just try to rein him in.
Right.
Let's get through this because we don't want to mess this up. You know, especially in front of these guys. They didn't cancel this one band to hire us.
Right, right, right.
Anyway, the gig is going, and it's not going bad, you know. I mean, I can hear Jimmy. He's not his normal self over there, but okay, as long as we're getting through it. All of a sudden, I see people laughing. And I'm standing in the line.
Yeah.
So I don't see exactly what's going on, but I hear all of this mush coming out of the base. I steps back out of the line and looks. Jimmy had came in with, he had this big, loud, yellow sweatsuit outfit on.
Yeah.
And he had the drawstring, and it came undone, and his pants had fell down around his ankles. So he tried to pull his pants up with one hand and tried to play the bass with the other hand while he leaned up against his amplifier. I wanted to kill him.
Oh, man.
So
it seems like a lot of these stories, when I ask someone, it comes down to nudity or somebody screwing up, you know, like there's a nude person in the audience. I've heard that a few times or something, you know.
Well,
that's,
you know,
funny.
What? I've kind of seen that and really realized what I was looking at once. I was going back and forth to Myrtle Beach.
Okay.
With Matt Necessary. And we played at the bike rally.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, it's this big, huge venue, you know, all the vendors and stuff. And I see this one girl, you know, one of the, like, Budweiser girls walking around with the trays of drinks and stuff.
Right.
And I'm looking at this tuxedo. I'm like, man, that's a nice black and red tuxedo she got on. Until she got up close enough for me to notice it wasn't a tuxedo. It was body paint.
Oh.
She was naked as a Jaybird. But you couldn't tell. You know,
yeah, right.
You had
right.
to really look. And I'm like, oh, holy shit.
Well, how about great gigs, memorable ones? Did you ever open for anybody famous or that type of stuff?
I've opened for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But the one where I really came really close,
Mm-hmm.
And this was also with Red the Willing and Able. We were playing at the Warner Theater.
Oh.
On a show with a group at the time by the name of Pleasure.
Okay.
They were a recording band.
All right.
And they, all kind of albums. Their guitar player was one of my favorite guitarists. His name was Marlon McLean. They called him the Magician.
Okay.
And at the time, he was getting ready to leave the band. Well, Frank, our trombone player, had told me this. He said, Barry, you know, I overheard this. So there's this one song, I forget which one it was. I think it was one of Rick James tunes that I took this real hot guitar solo.
Yeah.
And he said, look, take it twice. Because
right.
These guys gonna be listening. I'm like, okay. So that night, and it just so happened that was a good night too, man. The band was kicking, and I mean, everything was just falling into place. And I'm standing there, man. When I get my time, I'm hitting it, and you know, I'm not even seeing the audience.
Yeah.
And I'm just in that zone, you know. I see Frank going, look, pointing his finger. I turned around, and not only were two of the other members, but the dude, Marlon McLean,
yeah.
He's standing there in the wing on the side up there looking at me going,
all right.
Shaking his head.
Nice.
They don't get no better than that.
Did you get to meet him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the band disbanded after that, but I did hear that I was in the running.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Wow, that's super cool. Yeah.
That would have been cool because I really liked that group too but at the time. Pleasure.
Playing at the Warner. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it was. I by that time, I had played at the Warner a few times.
Oh, you had? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I opened up for a group called Sun, BT Express.
Okay.
We you know, back then, just about all the R&B shows that would come into the Warner Theater, either Our Band or Sky's the Limit Band or some opened up for them. So.
So Sky's the Limit, Ready, Willing, and Able.
Yeah.
Top Shelf even? Or?
Well, Top Shelf,
that was later.
We opened up for Victoria, I forgot her last name. She was on Saturday Night Live.
Victoria Principal.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, wait a minute. Ain't Victoria Principal the
right?
actress?
Yeah, you were right.
Yeah, but this is a comedian. Her name was Victoria something,
yeah,
I forget.
Jackson?
Yeah.
Victoria Jackson.
That's it.
Yeah,
Victoria Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Top Shelf, we opened up for her.
Okay.
So...
Gotcha. Yeah. So my podcast goes to the end of the 80s. Have we reached the end of the 80s for you? Top Shelf, that was throughout most of the 80s, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, I started a list of the places that you played. We talked about the Hedge Hollow Inn, Ramada Inn.
Ramada Inn's.
Madeline's.
Yep. Now, that was my room. Well, it wasn't called Madeline's then. It was...
What was it?
Players Club.
Players, right, yep. Right. You played at the Peak.
Yep.
Tim's Tavern.
Yep. that was a wild one.
Was it? I didn't even know where Tim's Tavern was. I had to look it up. 340 East 12th Street.
Yeah, we used to call it the Cubby Hole because you had to go through this. You know where Midas Muffler is?
Yeah.
Back behind there was where Tim's Tavern was.
Oh, so that's not where the door was. That's where the tavern was.
Yeah, that's where the tavern was.
Oh, okay. So it was a small little place.
Yeah, it was little.
All right.
You used to get a nice crowd. And
yeah.
They had a stage. So.
Oh, they did. Okay. Country Classic Restaurant out near the Peak.
Yeah, we played both of those, Country Classic and the Peak.
Okay. AJ's on East Lake Road.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Vaguely.
A lot of these places, I was going to say, you played so much, you probably don't even remember them. The Blue Moon Saloon.
The Blue Moon Saloon.
What was that?
That was it was like a, kind of like a cafe, kind of on the order of a small version of the, like the lounge at Peak and Peak. It was kind of like that, like, almost like if he was in a big VFW.
Okay. Oh, gotcha.
You know.
Yeah, because you're a five-piece band, right?
Yeah.
And Town Terrace.
Town Terrace. Now, that was one of those rooms that we used to keep in our back pocket. He didn't pay all of that much, but we could play there anytime we wanted.
Oh, really? Yeah.
You know, people out there, they loved us. So, like, during the winter and some of the off months where after the holidays and things with gigs and stuff kind of started slowing down a little bit, we always knew we had a couple of things like Town Terrace and the Peak.
Right.
We kind of had those in our pocket.
Town Terrace is a good size room. I played there. Had some of my equipment stolen from there.
I used to tell my bass player, I said, one of these days I'm gonna get loaded and y'all gonna come out here and I'm gonna be riding that horse. Remember the horse they
that's
had
right,
out
front? Front. Yeah, that's right. Players, the old Aunt Mary's, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
How was that?
That was a hot room.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Room.
And the three main bands in that room, and I'm gonna get. And if I had to put them in 1, 2, 3 order, I would say the Moonlight is first.
Okay.
Top Shelf second, and then Angel Fire.
Sure, those are all big bands of the 80s. Yeah. Yeah. And Stax was the last one I had. Stax Parkview Pub out in Northeast.
Northeast, yeah.
Yeah. You guys played all over the place. Did you go out of town?
Yeah, we used to go up to, we played out in the county a lot.
Okay,
too, so.
Right.
And we down in Meadville and up by Pittsburgh.
Okay. All right.
Cleveland.
Gotcha. So Top Shelf goes through the 80s. Tell me about the Gigolo Band. What was that? I love the name. When was it and who was it?
Oh, that was me. My friend Jimmy Johnson, my longtime drummer friend is deceased now, Robert Poole.
Okay.
And Peter Barnett. He played organ and he used to sing. Peter was a wonderful singer.
Hmm.
And we were pretty much local, just local bands. Just I don't even know how that name came up.
I wondered, was it?
But,
I mean,
we all kind of had a few girls back in the day. Yeah. You know, like Peter was, I guess. Peter was the harem leader, but and I still don't exactly remember how that name came out.
No, yeah, I don't even know how I found that name, to be honest with you. But it was like a '70s.
Yeah, we used to.
Yeah,
before Peter came on, we were a 3-piece band.
Okay,
and we were kind of hard to handle. We were hard to handle 3-piece band, but we used to do little stuff that no other guys were doing at the time. We had a. Stuff that you could look at, you know. Like, for instance, at one point, I would put my bass player up on my shoulders, and we'd be playing and rocking and stuff, and my drummer, he'd stand up and play and take his shirt and throw it all up his head and walk around his drums. And all kind of things like that.
Yeah, so, it was a show.
Yeah.
What type of music?
Back then, I was playing R&B and classic rock.
Okay.
Because I'd play for a lot of festivals and stuff, and I'm going to say, you know, I'm gonna try to please everybody here.
Sure, right.
I'm gonna have R&B for my R&B fans, but it's gonna be some rock and rollers out there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I always like classic rock.
Yeah.
Too. So.
What'd you like classic rock? Type of stuff?
Oh wow! It's
like Aerosmith, Zeppelin.
I love Aerosmith.
Do you really?
Zeppelin. Bob Seger.
Bob Seger, yeah.
Even some of the Southern rockers, like Georgia Satellites. And,
oh, yeah, yeah. Keep your hands to yourself.
Yeah. I used to do that song myself.
Did you?
And then, you know, some of the crossover guys, Huey Lewis,
because mm-hmm.
I play harmonica also. You know, and,
of course you do. And, you play everything.
Robert Palmer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that is like that's quite a cross, you know, genres. But that's, I guess, at the time.
Well, you
that
know,
was
I
the
mean,
stuff you had to play, right?
I never prejudiced against music.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of my friends in school, they used to get on me all the time about why I was learning, why I'm learning this, why you learning Pink Floyd, why you learning this. We trying to play James Brown. I was like, well, I can play that too, but I can play this too. And if it sounds good to me, if I like it, I'm going to play it.
Right, right.
Plus, like I said, once again, the more people I can please, the more work I can get.
That's right. I think that's a good motto for us to end on. I mean, that's pretty much how you've ran your whole musical career, right? I mean,
yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. I called a square dance one time.
You did?
Yep. I'm trying to think of where in the county we was playing. It was a wedding reception, but it was in a barn.
Okay.
And it was a reception after a reception, because we had played the little pomp and circumstance thing, you know.
Sure.
At the whole, for the older people, but then we all pushed the party to they had the property had this barn on it. They had laid down plywood and stuff all out there. I mean, it was a real barn.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody had went and they come out of their wedding dresses and wedding outfits and stuff, and they was ready to party. And we in there, and just for a hoot, I was like, hey, Dan, y'all just follow me. And I just started, hey, now look all around, your partner, she's the gal from Arkansas. Start doing this square dance. And you'd be surprised, it was people in there.
They got right into it.
Knee slapping and getting into it. And was, Dan looked at me and said, boy, one of these days you're going to get us killed.
Yeah. That was probably the last time you ever played a square dance, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was perfect. I mean, the setting was perfect.
Yeah,
was
right,
just
right.
One of those things. I used to think I was going to get shot for doing Elvis Presley.
Oh, yeah?
But people seem to like it.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. What else? Do I missed anything?
Probably, but you know.
What happened after the 80s? Who did you play with? Like I said, the podcast goes to the end of 80s, but you continued playing, and most everybody does.
The 90s is pretty much where is up to almost right now. That's where I started.
Okay.
At the Beer Mug and different places. Started meeting a whole new group of musicians because I was putting together another band at the time, and I was looking for people, you know, and all that. And my thing was, I needed musicians that were at least at the caliber I was.
Sure.
Because I was getting a little too old to go back in the basement for a long time,
right.
Years of time. So I wanted to see some of these veteran guys. And you know, I started meeting another group of young musicians that were coming up and, you know, doing different things with Roger Montgomery and all these guys,
right.
Ron Yaros.
Mm-hmm.
Started meeting those guys through the, you know, from going to the Beer Mug and all right, those that type of things.
Yeah.
And that's where I started to meet people like Mo Troop and all these. So we, and then that's like some of these guys.
Oh, yeah, and the pictures.
That's me and Mo Troop. And,
right.
With Skag, Swag, rather.
Right.
And I played with one of the first versions of the Breeze Band.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And, you know, so that's from the 90s on up. It was like, you know, Breeze Band, Barry King Blues Band, and all this type of stuff. So.
And the pictures that you showed me of you and Mary Alice Brown, were you just sitting in with her periodically? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she would ask me to come and sit with her.
Okay.
Come and sit in with her. Like,
yeah.
Mary Alice, she really didn't take a lot of jobs, but the ones she did, she had different people that she would utilize.
Gotcha.
I was one.
Cool.
But I've been knowing Mary. I call her Ma.
Yeah.
For a long time, and we always worked very well together.
That's great. Well, she's another one I'd like to have on the podcast someday. So.
Well, maybe.
All right. Well, Barry King, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. This was great. I learned a lot of new things, and I hope it brought back some good memories for you.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Some questionable, but
that's right. That's right. The guy with the yellow pants that are falling down, we'll just forget about him.
Yeah, and Dave Cathy wearing the lampshade on his head at the Peak and Peak. Let's forget about that too.
Okay. All right, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, man.
Thanks to Barry for having me. Thanks to Dennis Henderson for recommending Barry. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember to rate and or subscribe on whatever podcast app you use. And feel free to comment on our Facebook page. Special thanks to the JPT Foundation for supporting the podcast. I'm Chip Schell, and thanks again for listening to the Erie Music History Podcast.